You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to Poet Laureate Oscar Morales about his journey to becoming Madison's Poet Laureate.
First, the pharmaceutical company Pfizer says it will block the use of its drugs for capital punishment.
More than 20 drug companies have adopted similar restrictions. With Pfizer joining that list, there are no more open market options for states looking for lethal injection drugs.
That leaves states that use the death penalty scrambling to find supplies and looking to other methods to carry out their executions.
Megan McCracken joins us now to talk about the impact of Pfizer's decision. She's the Eighth Amendment Resource Counsel with the University of California School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. Megan, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why have Pfizer and other drug companies blocked their drugs for use in these capital punishment lethal injections?
Well, when we look back years and years, we see that the pharmaceutical companies have been telling the states since as early as 2001 that they don't want their products used in this way, that they make products to heal people, to promote health, and not to end lives. But it's only more recently, since 2011, that pharmaceutical companies have taken more effective concrete steps to actually prevent departments of corrections from getting their drugs. And so the policy has always been there. It's just that more recently they have put what they call restricted distribution systems in place to actually stop the states from purchasing the drugs.
So why now? Did they just figure out how to do this? Or has public pressure and the risk of public outcry, I guess, about the use of their products and capital punishment been driving this?
I think it's an increase in knowledge and information. So as the pharmaceutical companies became specifically aware, not just that drugs that they make are being used, but that their drugs were being used, you know, that was an impetus. And as information travels more quickly and becomes more available, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are big brand names. And so they have stakeholders, and they have brand images and bottom lines to protect. And so, you know, they're taking these steps as business decisions in the best interest of their brand names.
And you mentioned the information is out there. In some cases, that information, at least in a lot of states, is hard to get. States are not forthcoming about the source of the drugs they use in lethal injections. What are we seeing out there?
That is certainly a consequence that we are seeing, that as pharmaceutical companies have made their drugs unavailable to departments of corrections for this use, states have responded by passing laws to make the information about how they get their drugs, exactly what the drugs are, increased amounts of information surrounding execution procedures. They're making that confidential and unavailable. And that's, it makes it very difficult for the public, for the courts, and for condemned prisoners to really know how an execution is going to proceed, like exactly what drug will be used, who made it, how did the state get it. Information like that is increasingly difficult to impossible to get.
Given that that information is, as you say, difficult to impossible to get, what do we know about how states have been reacting as more and more companies take their drugs off the table for lethal injection?
Sure. So we know that some states are using phenobarbital, that they are sourcing from compounding pharmacies. Other states could be doing that, but for unrelated and various reasons haven't been carrying out executions. So it's possible that if these states resume executions, they also could go to compounding pharmacies. But beyond that, you know, again, because of the secrecy, we often have no information about how states are getting their drugs or exactly what those drugs are. Additionally, we have seen some states attempt to import unapproved drugs from overseas. That is actually not legal under federal law, but we have seen those efforts. And then we've seen some states looking to older methods, to bring back older methods that have been phased out, and bringing those in as alternatives, sort of just in case they're unable to get execution drugs.
Yeah, did I see at one point the federal government, federal law enforcement, had impounded one of those attempts to import these lethal injection drugs in a state?
Right. So several years ago, many states imported thiopental from overseas, from England and also from, from India. And federal agents went around and arranged for the transfer of those drugs. More recently, Texas and Arizona attempted to import the same drug from India, and when the drugs arrived to the port of entry, they were held, which is what federal law requires. So that was not really a surprise, given that the law says that such drugs shall not enter the country. There's no discretion there.
Talking to Megan McCracken from the University of California School of Law's Death Penalty Clinic. A major drug company, Pfizer, has added its name to the list of companies to say they will not allow their products to be used in lethal injections on the death penalty, basically the last company on the list. Megan, lethal injection, I think, became the main mode of capital punishment some time ago because it was viewed as, I guess, a more humane alternative to an electric chair or a firing squad. What we've seen in recent years, are people still making that argument?
People are, and I think the problem is, one major problem is that for many, many years, every prisoner who was executed by lethal injection was paralyzed. And so it was a procedure that would look entirely humane no matter what was actually happening. And so more recently, we have seen evidence of many botched executions where the prisoners are struggling, writhing, and displaying signs of pain and suffering. And so increasingly, if the prisoner is not paralyzed, we see that sometimes the execution works as planned, but sometimes it does not.
And a lot of the argument here over the use of particular combinations of drugs centers around the idea that, as you say, in these botched cases, it's a cruel and unusual punishment. At the same time, that's been an argument against the death penalty itself, whatever the form. How do you tease out that argument?
Well, they really look at different issues. So certainly both arguments exist, but the larger argument related to the death penalty writ large being unconstitutional touches on many different factors, including, its overall unfairness that is racially biased, that innocent people are sentenced to death and executed, and that there's no rhyme or reason to who receives a death sentence. There are many different claims related to that larger argument about capital punishment in general, as compared to the more specific argument that a particular method or procedure would violate the Eighth Amendment as specifically, for creating pain and suffering.
So where are we now with all these companies taking their products off the market? Are we seeing, in effect, a de facto end to capital punishment in some states as they have no way to carry out their current mode of capital punishment?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. We really haven't seen a state say at this point, we're not carrying out executions because we can't get drugs. We've certainly seen states prepare for that, so they have put some plans in place or they have complained and said this might happen. But we haven't seen it happen yet, and so we'll have to see what plays out as now that Pfizer has made its drugs unavailable, and there really is sort of an industry-wide voice saying we don't want our products used this way, whether that will translate to the states struggling to actually get drugs, I think remains to be seen.
Now, Wisconsin is not a state with a death penalty currently, but the federal government does have capital punishment. We've seen in Massachusetts the Boston Marathon bombing. That was an issue there. What's the federal government doing? Not that they're doing a lot of executions, but do they have a plan in place?
They do not. They have lethal injection litigation going on, and the government has announced that it's working on a new protocol and will be announcing it. So they're working on defining new procedures now.
We'll leave it there for now. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's law expert Megan McCracken talking about the impact of the drug company Pfizer's new decision to block its drug from being used in lethal injections.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, men still vastly outnumber women in politics here in Wisconsin and beyond. Our guest looks at the gender-based hate that some women in politics face when they decide to lead in the public eye.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. There are many kinds of homes, from the place we actually live to the coffee shop that's an extension of our living room. When poet Kim Blazer moved to Milwaukee, she found her book home in a place that's been nurturing poets and celebrating poetry for decades.
The year is 1987, and I am an acronym, ABD, all but dissertation graduate student, just hired to teach at UW-Milwaukee. During my first month, I find a book home. A longtime haunter of bookstores, I have particular needs. This place measures up. Eclectic, homey, customer-friendly, and with good reading chairs. This is no chain bookstore. This is a nonprofit book center specializing in poetry and fine print materials. Soon I discover the three-room book center also sponsors community programs, readings, workshops, experimental films, youth camps, music performances, anything in the arts, including an edible book show. One year, in a time before Facebook, I receive a word-of-mouth notice that Tuvan throat singers would perform. Imagine hearing one person produce multiple vocal sounds simultaneously, their bagpipe bodies defying the limitations of a single voice box. In the days that follow, I try churning new sounds from my throat, and I count this profit to my poetry. I relished bringing student writers into this community space where book lovers gather, many of them reading in public for the first time, their grandparents and college roommates in tow. We pause when we are done to mingle and talk about their talent, their hunger for a life that someone somewhere does not support, about books when we get by all the rest. This Renaissance Book Center was founded in 1979 by artist Anne Kingsbury and poet Carl Gartung. The name, Woodland Pattern. Now the year is 2015. I have just picked up world-renowned poet Quincy Troupe from the airport and his first request to go to Woodland Pattern. The year is 2016. 143 poets have signed up to perform five-minute slots in the 22nd Annual Poetry Marathon. 10 hours in, during the 7 to 8 hour, I challenge the poets to recite by heart a poem by a poet they love. Many take up the challenge, reciting snippets or whole poems with a particular frivolity I attribute to the atmosphere of the place as much as the late hour. Writers I meet from around the country inquire about Woodland Pattern as if asking about a cultural landmark. Indeed, perhaps they do. This book-scented building, this Milwaukee River West storefront with changing artwork on its exterior walls, has welcomed the likes of Alice Notley, Joy Harjo, Ed Saunders, Diane Wachowski, and it has welcomed me.
Kim Blazer is Wisconsin's Poet Laureate. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org.
We just heard from Wisconsin's Poet Laureate, and joining us now is Oscar Morales, who was recently named the City of Madison's Poet Laureate. Oscar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you brought along a book of your work today in studio, and you're going to start us out with a poem about Father's Day, so a little bit early there. What have you got for us?
This is a poem I wrote a couple years ago for my children, and it goes like this. Father's Day poem, a day late. My children are old enough to know it is Father's Day, but the younger two are not old enough to work or buy gifts. So my girlfriend got the gift, an electronic Sudoku game, and my daughter and son gave it to me. No, it wasn't wrapped, except with the delight on their faces, giving me something they knew I would like. My 19-year-old son, who just got his first summer college area subleased apartment, but not enough money for food or toilet paper, decided to text me this message. Happy Father's Day, Pop, at 9:33 p.m. the day before, just in case he forgot to wake up before noon the next day. My other son, the 18-year-old, who headed off to college a little early, sent me an e-card. Happy Father's Day. It's too bad I can't be home this weekend, but happy Father's Day. And it reminded me that just being remembered is the greatest gift one can ask for from teenagers on Father's Day.
Oscar, thanks a lot for sharing that. What first got you into writing poetry and expressing these kind of feelings in poetry form?
Well, I was born in a family of 12 children. Some of them I'm related to, other ones I love. And it was part of the journey was trying to find my voice. When you have 12 siblings and a couple of friends and parents thrown in, it's hard to find your voice.
So how did you do that? Through poetry? How did you know when it was the voice, the authentic voice of Oscar coming through?
Well, I'm a naturally shy person, so I had a little time to think. And since my brothers and sisters didn't give me time to speak, I had to make sure that the little moments I had, that I had something to say. So it forced me to go inside a little bit deeper at a lot younger age.
What is it about poetry that harness your voice so, not concisely exactly, but so powerfully?
Well, I think poetry is one of the few things that can distill pretty complex issues into something simple. Like this poem's about Father's Day, and yes, children are supposed to honor their parents, but I think it's gotten too commercialized, and I think for me it was just the fact that they were old enough to still kind of think about me, because sometimes when they're a little younger, you sort of get a little more inner focus, but the fact that they thought about me made a big difference.
Now, you're the poet laureate in Madison, and I'm curious, what are the duties of the poet laureate? What do you do to keep the spirit of poetry alive?
Well, last week I was at Shabazz High School on a Friday afternoon around 2:30, a couple weeks before school ended, and I started off sharing that when I was 16, 17, the last place I'd want to be is listen to poetry. You know, on a Friday afternoon, but they hung in there, and they were wonderful. They were very supportive. Young people don't clap anymore. They snap their fingers. I can't do it anymore. But they were just very responsive and very good. And yesterday I had, there was a poetry marathon at Olbrich Gardens, and later on next week I'll be showcasing the graphic artwork that was done by Edgewood College students for the Bus Lines Poetry. So they're keeping me busy.
Now, poetry seems like one of the most personalized forms of expression, so it's hard to give one-size-fits-all advice. That said, if there are people out there thinking, I want to start or maybe get back to writing poetry, what would you say to them?
Grab a pen, you know, and just as you write, ask the editor to leave the room. So when you write, have that freedom to not censor yourself, have that freedom to find that truth a little easier. Actually, right now I type on my cell phone, so it's a little easier. But writing fearlessly, and it's scary and it's vulnerable, but that's where you find the most powerful poetry.
I know that the poetry often reflects the inner state of the poet, the turmoil or the joy. But does the poetry you write ever turn around and change you?
I think as I read some poetry that I've written a lot of poems, but and I'm not as organized as I'm supposed to be, but when I find pieces that I've written 10 or 15 years ago, I find work that is really impresses me because it's actually pretty good, and I sort of almost can't believe I wrote it. So that's always kind of refreshing. But I think it's it took me a long while to share with other people that I was a poet, because I wanted to honor the art and the craft. And one of the nice things of being poet laureate is a lot more people are coming up to me and saying that, one, they didn't know I was a writer. Half the people don't know I'm a writer because I'm a school principal, wrestling coach, and I'm a community activist. But they're writing again, and I think that's been probably the greatest joy, is inspiring other people to write again.
Briefly, Oscar, when you ask people around the world what they know about Wisconsin, I'm guessing poetry won't be at the top of their list, but do we have a thriving poetry scene here in the state?
Yes, I think it's led by the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets. They produce the poetry calendar. The UW has a fine MFA program that's produced just some delightful writers, including one of our writers in the book, Luana Montero. I think my book, I didn't know there were Latinos in Wisconsin. It's not as famous as the Packers, but getting close.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, sharing poetry and talking poetry with us today.
Thanks a lot.
That was poet Oscar Morales, who was recently named the City of Madison's Poet Laureate, author of the book I Didn't Know There Were Latinos in Wisconsin.
Coming up, name-calling, appearance trolling, and sexual suggestion, they're all part of what women in politics face online and off. We'll find out how women active in Wisconsin's political scene handle the hate. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7, The Reveal looks at alleged abuse and neglect of people with disabilities at specialty rehab centers across the United States, going on for over 40 years. It's coming up after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as social media gives more women in politics the platforms they need to reach voters, it also gives the public an easy way to bombard those same women with hate and sexist comments.
Studies show that some women may be deterred from getting into politics out of fear they'd have to face sexist remarks or hateful personal attacks. And it's not just social media that can pose a problem. In Wisconsin, some women in politics say the media and party organizations themselves can be drivers of unfair behavior towards women. And in a state where men still vastly outnumber women in the legislature, our next guest wanted to know what the experience of women in politics is like.
Jessie O'Poyan joins us now. She's a reporter for the Capital Times in Madison, and she recently wrote a piece about the issue called Handling Hate, and it's up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. Jessie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jessie, the first line of your piece is this: women in politics have to deal with a lot of garbage. So a strong first line. Tell us what exactly we're talking about here.
Yeah. So this story actually came about because of a lot of stories that had accumulated in my mind, I guess, after hearing them from different elected officials who are women. And it's sort of a thing that you acknowledge for a long time, like, oh, yeah, we all have to deal with this stuff. And then you realize it's actually kind of striking. So it's tweets, it's Facebook posts, it's emails, it's criticisms that are more based on appearance than on substance and policy. It's sexual comments, it's very vulgar, sometimes violent language. And that's not to say that men don't put up with a lot of nasty comments from, you know, constituents or folks who are upset with them too, but it just takes on a different tone with women. And I had heard so many stories of so many things that different women had gone through that eventually I thought maybe there's actually kind of a story here.
Right. And does it seem as though each woman is going through it individually, and it seems like it could almost be wallpaper to her, but when cumulatively, when you add it all together, it's actually something that it seems like it needs maybe to be addressed or at the very least talked about.
It is. And I think, maybe not a lot of women, but some women may be afraid to talk about it, afraid of coming across as whiny, or thinking, well, you know, you're in politics, you've got to have a thick skin, you've got to toughen up and deal with some of this. And there is a lot of criticism that you are expected to deal with in elected office, but some of this goes so far beyond that. And to not necessarily share that experience, you think, oh, this is just something that I'm going through. And as they start to talk, these women start to realize, well, this isn't bound to one party. It's not even criticism that's just coming from men. It's comments that are coming from women too. And it's this very shared experience that is not really talked about all that much.
And you write that the attacks against women, like you just said, they're not unique to women, but that they are, it seems like, more personal. How personal does it get?
it can get incredibly personal. I talked to a few women who had mentioned their children hearing things at school, and you know, that could very well happen to men too, but I think a lot of women are more in tune to that, knowing just sort of that playing that more traditional mother role. It can be one elected official mentioned being told, I hope your husband's sleeping with your best friend. It's words that don't necessarily have an equivalent for men, maybe, say calling women the C word or the B word, or going after them for being more assertive in a way that that men just aren't really getting. And it's things about their appearance or more sexual language that can become violent often.
And so how do the women, and you talk to a wide variety of women across the political spectrum, Republicans and Democrats, was there any constant that emerged about how women cope with things like this?
There were a couple things. Many of them had sort of the thought of try to ignore social media or stay away from it. The problem with that, of course, is this is also a really fantastic tool for elected officials. They use it to see what their constituents are concerned about. They use it to connect with them and to get their message out in a different way. But, you know, there's sort of a point at which if you're getting so much hate, you need to stay away from it. Some of them mentioned having, if they were actually in office, having their staff screen things before they read them so they could know, you know, if this is something that might be damaging to see. And I think something that hasn't necessarily happened yet, but something that a couple of them mentioned is just it would be nice to talk about it more with other women who are experiencing that, just to sort of know that it's out there.
Why do you think they haven't talked about it more until, I mean, I don't know if they will after your article, but why hasn't it been a thing where they can get together and share some of what they're going through? Because some of it sounds like it could have the potential to be traumatic.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's not to say that they're not talking about it at all. I think there's some casual conversations going on, and some of those do cross party lines. I spoke with one representative who said she has talked with some women just about things like, oh, it's hard to be a legislator and juggle your kids, you know, school schedules and activity schedules, things like that, or even sharing experiences of feeling like their safety had been threatened. But I think a theory on why it hasn't been discussed in a more formal or organized way is here in Wisconsin, we have a pretty relatively young legislature, inexperienced legislature. They just haven't been around all that long. And so there's sort of a feeling of you need to learn the ropes before you start to make any changes or before you start to organize new things. And I think there's some talk of just, you know, where they're not in a place where they feel like they can do that yet, but maybe now will be the time.
We're talking about sexism and hate that may face women in politics with Jessie O'Poyne. She wrote about it for the Capital Times in Madison. And Jessie, tell us about some of the people that you did speak with and tell us a few of the stories that they shared with you.
Sure. You know, I mentioned the woman who was told, I hope your husband sleeps with your best friend. That was former State Representative Michelle Litchens. And she was in the legislature during Act 10, which is a particularly contentious time for everyone in the legislature. And there was a lot of vitriol directed at men and women and really politicians on both sides of the aisle. She had a couple of situations like that where she mentioned, you know, people attacks getting really personal in terms of talking about her family, talking about her kids, talking about her husband. An interesting perspective, I think, was Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, who's a Republican, and she was a TV reporter before she was in politics. So she was sort of used to this already. TV reporters get a lot of this. They get a lot of comments about their appearance, and she had sort of been prepared for what she might get in office just by having people email and call over the years saying, you know, you should have different hair, you should wear a better color for your skin tone. But even still, the comments take on another tone because, you know, there's policy involved and there's stronger feelings involved in politics. Both Representative Litchens and Representative Melissa Sargent, who's a Democrat, mentioned being on the campaign trail and having people ask, well, how are you going to raise your kids and run for office? How are you going to serve in office and take care of your family? And feeling that had it been a husband or boyfriend or male counterpart, probably not the same question would have been asked.
And you even spoke with a woman who I think said she was out visiting her constituents and had a business owner try to take her clothes off in some sort of setting.
Yes. That was Representative Melissa Sargent, who you know, didn't want to name the man, but had loved, you know, going out into the field and meeting with her constituents, had always done it alone, went out to meet with a male business owner, didn't think anything of it. And she says he tried to remove her suit jacket And she immediately, you know, feared for her safety and now has to consider that every time she goes out to meet with constituents in a way that a man may not consider.
Well, and so here we are in Wisconsin. It's not unique to Wisconsin, but there are far fewer women in the legislature than there are men. This is true nationally as well. I believe it's true, you know, largely across the country, although the balance is a little better if you go some places in Europe, I know. But how do you think this affects the way women think about whether or not they want to run for office?
I think it gives them pause. I think it makes them sometimes second guess it. You see that your private life, your family's life, things that you wouldn't expect to put on the table beyond, say, campaign season, if at that, are going to be up for grabs at any moment while you're serving in the public arena. And that's a lot to take on, not just for yourself, but for the people in your life and the people that you care about. One of the women that I spoke to for the article who runs a program that trains and recruits women for office mentioned, though, that when you don't run for office, you don't necessarily get to not experience sexism. So you can run for office and you can try to change it from within instead.
And looking at issues of safety, so if some of these women receive something that could be construed as a threat, as something that might give a person pause for their personal safety or for their family's safety, is there any kind of protection that comes with the job?
I mean, it kind of depends. Certainly, yes. I mean, as regardless of the gender, if there's a threat, you know, law enforcement is there to take care of that. Where it can be a little dicey is social media and what the chain of command is on that. So maybe something might appear to be harassment on Twitter and you might go to Twitter to try to take care of that. That can be a lot more complicated than something that's a direct and clear threat that you can take to law enforcement.
We're talking with Jessie O'Poyne right now, talking about sexism and hate that can face women in politics. Jessie is a reporter for the Capital Times in Madison.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you see this, women in politics facing more personal attacks, sexism? What, if anything, could be done about it? And have you ever considered running for office if you're a woman? Did fear of this kind of thing, of online trolling, other kinds of harassment, make you think twice about it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find Jessie's article on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation now about the vitriol and the sexism that can face women in politics.
Jessie O'Poyne was with us, reporter for the Capital Times. She wrote about this recently. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think keeps more women from running for office? If you're a woman who ran for office, maybe got elected even, have you been the victim of the kind of online or other kinds of harassment, trolling? We're talking about that. What can be done to make things safer, more even? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We have Eric on the line in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Hey, so one thing, and this is less a personal attack, but it's an attack, I think, that is against women, and it comes from congressional Republican leaders who, as they've been blocking Merrick Garland's nomination, have talked about how they're all afraid of a radical Hillary nominee to the Supreme Court. Now, anybody would recognize that Bernie Sanders is generally seen as the more liberal Democrat, so why is it that they're so afraid of a Hillary nominee? And I think it's because Hillary's a woman. 100% of the women who have served on the Supreme Court have supported women's rights for their own health care. And the fact that these Republicans are saying Hillary is going to have some radical nominee, really that's just code for that she would maybe nominate a woman or somebody who's going to, you know, support contraceptive and abortion rights.
Eric, thanks a lot for the thoughts. And Jessie, you kept it in Wisconsin for this piece, but do you have any insight about what Eric's talking about there with the Hillary Clinton nomination?
Yeah, I did keep this mostly Wisconsin-focused, but in talking to women particularly who are Democrats or progressives, I think they have felt like they've even witnessed some of that from within their own party. I guess you the term you could debate, but you hear about the quote Bernie bros, but folks who are maybe supporting Bernie Sanders and are implementing a sexist rhetoric in the way that they criticize Hillary Clinton. And we saw a lot of women in the state legislature here, Democrats who endorsed Hillary Clinton for president before the primary, got a lot of hatred for that. A lot of it coming from Democrats and some of it being comments like, quote, dumb C words, vote for dumb C words. So that is definitely an element at play.
And I know you spoke with Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who said that she feels that she's gotten and she has seen different treatment within the party directed at women who are running and also at herself. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and she talked about that, obviously coming from the perspective of a black woman in Congress, which is even more rare than a woman in general in Congress. She was looking particularly at a Senate primary in Maryland between a black woman and a white man. The white man was sort of the favored to win by the state Democratic Party there. And Congresswoman Moore felt like the attacks on the woman in the race were both sexist and racist, and a lot of them coming from a narrative from the party dealing with the kind of reducing the woman, Representative Donna Edwards, to a single mother, nothing more than a woman who had raised a child despite, you know, many other career accomplishments. And Gwen Moore mentioned constantly being referred to for the longest time in many newspaper articles as a, you know, former welfare recipient, and feeling like that was sort of the same treatment of just getting that dig in there and taking her down a few pegs for being both a woman and for being black.
We go back to our callers now. We've got Anissa on the line with us from Southern Wisconsin. Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
I'm good. Thanks for calling. What did you want to share?
Well, I'm Anissa Welch, and I'm running for the 43rd Assembly seat as a representative. And when you were talking about all of the things that women consider before running, this is definitely something that I talked with my family about. And it's something that was a concern for them, even when I ran for city council. But ultimately, we decided that it was worth it, and that they were willing to make those sacrifices too for the community and to have a positive impact. But it's definitely something that weighs on everybody's mind. But I want to encourage more women to run and to talk about it, because I don't think it gets better if we don't have these discussions.
Anissa, thank you so much. And did you talk to any women who maybe made the opposite decision that you made and decided not to run because of it?
Yeah, I've talked to women that, and part of it was those questions about how do you raise your family and how do you balance everything out. And I think women just take a lot more time and consideration before they even decide to run. But yes, I do know that this deters women from running.
Anissa, thank you so much for that. And there's a politician in Wisconsin here who had to weigh that decision with her family. And I imagine that is something that anyone who's going to get in politics has to do with their family, make that decision. But what extra considerations might women have to make when they're considering something like this with their family?
Sure. I mean, man or woman, you are going, you should be, I would think, taking into consideration the interests of your family and knowing that anything they do or not even anything they do, but just any association they have with you may be put into the spotlight. And that's something that they should be comfortable with. But because women are still more traditionally seen in that mother role and as being more tied to their families, you know, for better or worse, that's another line of attack for them in another way. And there's sort of a double-edged sword, I guess, of you're going to face those questions of how do you raise your kids? Or if you're a, say, single woman or a woman who is married but doesn't have children, you're going to get questions about that too. And those are not questions you want to necessarily answer in your personal life, let alone in your career.
Anissa, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. As we look at sexism in politics and how it may be keeping some women out of politics altogether and might be making other women think about things differently and have to make choices. We'll take another caller now. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I think look at the discourse that Hillary Clinton has had to put up with from the very beginning when she was trying to work on the health care committee. She was a pushy woman that hadn't been elected. What did she think she was doing? And now she's untrustworthy. I don't think male candidates are held to the same standard that she's been subjected to.
Barbara, Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. And Jesse, different standards for men and women. What did you hear on that front?
Yeah, there are a bunch of studies out there on this looking at, say, a CEO, one named Joe and one named Jody, or, you know, substitute gendered names here, and giving them the same characteristics, same accomplishments, and showing that people are generally just more inclined to think that the male CEO is more fit for the job, is more likable, you name it. And women just face different standards for being likable. If you are assertive, if you are aggressive, if you are ambitious, those are not viewed as positive characteristics for a woman. You are supposed to be a little more demure. You're supposed to be a little friendlier. And those are the things that also hold women back in terms of trying to just get ahead, because those are things you need to be a leader and to be successful.
We haven't talked yet about Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley, another woman that you profiled in your article, and she talked a bit about how she said she got unfair treatment, as she saw it, from the Journal Sentinel in some coverage of her. Now, this is not looking at online stuff, but the media in particular. What did she say to you?
Yeah, she was focusing. I mean, she had kind of a couple weeks of unflattering headlines about a number of things from her past. And one of those articles ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It was a story about a case where she had represented in a custody case a man she had dated in the past. She had been dating him while she was still legally married to her ex-husband. Both she and her ex-husband said they were working on separating. They were working on getting divorced at the time. They're not living together. But the headline referred to it as an extramarital affair. This is something she took huge issue with, says she believes was sexist treatment, and putting a giant headline with the word extramarital, or the phrase extramarital affair, in it on the page. And she believed that a man wouldn't be subjected to the same treatment. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, for its part, said, well, we have treated men the same way in some situations, but I think she did feel that was a different standard for her.
And Jesse, just a few seconds left, but do you see this changing anything, your article and this conversation for women in politics?
Well, I hope so. I think it is brought to light for a lot of these women that they're not the only ones going through it. They're not the only party, whichever party they're on, going through it. So my hope is maybe it'll bridge the gap a little bit on some of those bipartisan conversations, particularly.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jesse O'Poyne. She wrote the article, Handling Hate: Women in Politics Face a Remarkable Amount of Sexist Vitriol. She works for the Capital Times.